Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast Supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Phil Tiger. Slacker Podcast.
Hello, Slackers. Welcome to this week's episode of the Slacker Podcast. Shout out and love to you all. Hope you're all doing good. And if you're not, let me take your mind off it, whatever shit it is, for the next 60 minutes with this sweet podcast that we've got with Run the Jewels. I love Run the Jewels. If you follow me on social media at Philly Tagger on Instagram or Twitter, you will see many, many posts about Run the Jewels. I've met them several times. I've had them on the book, and yeah, Killer Mike and LP are just like two legit OGs, big time. So I was so hyped to get Run the Jewels on season 4 of the Slacker Podcast. If you're brand new to the podcast and you haven't already, please subscribe to it. Please like it. Please review it. For 2 podcasts a week. Who else gives you 2 podcasts a week? Don't say Joe Rogan. Joe Rogan gets paid like £100 million. I get paid barely £1. So don't say Joe Rogan. But yeah, like last Friday was the launch of the new podcast, Slacker Friends, which is like a whole new format. It'll run aside the Slacker podcast. I mean, the podcast you're listening to right now will happen with different guests as usual, weekly. But the Slacker Friends podcast is kind of like it's like a sort of weird and wonderful panel show of all of the topical things that are happening in music that week. And I have 2 guests on with me every Friday, and it's going really well, but I'm totally busting my ass making content at the moment. And ideally, what I'd love to happen, what I would dream to happen, is to make a living out of making all of the Slacker content for you, the 2 podcasts, the various different YouTube videos, the mixes, all the rest of it. But I'm definitely not at that stage yet. So if any of you want to contribute the equivalent to a cup of coffee or a cup of tea or whatever to keep the wheels on the Slacker podcast and all things Slacker, then please go over to my Patreon and become a Slacker Patreon. That would be amazing. It's patreon.com/Slacker Podcast. I mean, the dream is independence. You don't have a boss telling you what to do. The only people telling me what to do are you guys, and you can tell me what you want to see, and I'll respond to it and I'll react to it. And that's how it works over at the Patreon. So patreon.com/Slacker Podcast. This podcast with Run the Jewels was recorded a couple of weeks before the Black Lives Matter movement, which saw an incredibly evocative speech from Killer Mike. So if anyone thinks that it's weird that we didn't mention it, it simply hadn't happened at that juncture yet. On the podcast, we have LP. Killer Mike was meant to come on and pulled out last second, but it's myself and LP talking about the RTJ weed strain that they're working on. Zach De La Rocca staying with LP in his basement after Rage Against the Machine broke up. Views on the music industry. Massive artists who they wanted on the album. And there are some really, really huge ones. And shooting their Run the Jewels movie. Tons more. This is the Slacker Podcast with Run the Jewels. In 3, 2, 1.
Thank you. Hello.
What's happening, Al? You good?
Hey, man. How you doing?
Yeah, I'm not too bad. All's good. All's good. I think the last time we talked was in Radio 1. That's where I do my shit from.
Yeah.
I've been doing a podcast for a couple of years, but I don't have to go to London anymore to do. I live in Brighton, so I live the bottom of the country, and this is fucking great. I'm not going near London when I don't have to. It's happy days.
Yeah. There's definitely that sort of side effect. You know, of course, the death and the horror and the insecurity and nervousness and stress on people's lives of this whole thing has been fucking insurmountable and really tragic in a lot of ways. And yet there's this other weird little after effect or weird little side effect that no one's really talking about too much, because it seems a little bit like it's distasteful to mention it. But there's another aspect of it where it's like, wait a second. So you're telling me that I could have worked from home the whole time? what do you mean? So technically I didn't have to come into the office, and eat the shitty sandwich from the place across the street, every day. That's something that you could have handled if you just put an hour of thought into it. I could have just had. So I think that's interesting. I wonder how people are going to react to having to go back to the daily grind of having to go back to now you have to come into this office.
Nah, man, this is seismic. This is a shift in humanity. This is a shift in paradigms. I think everything's going to completely. It's a line in the sand. There was the before times and there's the after times. You know what I mean? It feels like the way you your grandparents would have talked about a war, they would have talked before the war, after the war. This is our version of it. They'll talk about before and they'll talk about after.
It's true. I think you might be right. I wonder about that. I wonder, because even after a war, things did return to some semblance of normalcy in the basic way that humans, conducted themselves in society. I'm not sure about this one.
Yeah, big time. I mean, I was chatting to my dad the other day, and my dad was saying, there's going to be a massive baby boom from all this. And I was like, I see where you're coming from. Everybody's locked in. All they're going to do is shag rabbits when they're in. But I mean, part of me is going, people get awful lethargic, and it's not like it was in the 40s. There's Netflix. There's 100,000 million different apps that you can play with on your phone.
I myself bought a virtual reality headset.
Lots of virtual reality babies being born in 9 months' time.
Yeah. I mean, I'm so proud of him already.
Yeah, exactly. He's just a little darling. I mean,
he already knows how to run through hallways and shoot monsters. Every couple of years, I try and get back into gaming, and then I gear up, and my wife watches me sort of
rolls the eyes
pathetically, all right, this is it, sweetie. You never met this part of me, okay? This part of me existed before you met me, but now I'm getting back to my childhood.
Yeah.
And then it lasts for 45 minutes, and I'm like, oh, fuck, I'm an adult, aren't I? I'm an adult. but the virtual reality thing, I'll say that kind of got me. I've definitely spent a couple of hours over the last couple of days. I got an Oculus Quest, and I definitely am okay, this is sort of amazing. This is what we imagined when we were children. The idea of being in a virtual environment is no longer just fantasy, and it's no longer really bad and low res graphics and shit. It's actually real shit. And that's kind of getting to me. But I feel like not only is that sort of myth of the baby boom thing a constant, but the other myth is that you're going to be super creative during this time, when you're locked. I'm locked in and there's nothing to do. I'll just write that novel that I always knew I had in me. And then you're like, no, I'm just going to fucking eat and smoke weed and watch Netflix. Actually, I'm going to watch The Wire again.
Oh, dude. What am I on? Am I the third go round now? Fourth, maybe?
Oh, you're an amateur.
Really?
You're an amateur. Yeah, you got to get your numbers up. Double digits or you're not even in the game.
One thing I've taken from The Wire, and it has made its way into our lives, is that I come from Ireland, so everybody in Ireland and all my friends have fucked off all around the world to do different things and hang out in different places. And there would always be the Irish wake when they would leave. So we would lay them out on the pool table And
oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, shit.
Because that's not an Irish thing. That's an American thing. Like, that's American Irish, if you know what I mean. So, like, you know, we would do that. Like, it's pretty fun.
And I am American Irish, at least half.
You've got a couple of different things going on, don't you? Like, you've got, like, is it Lithuanian?
Some Lithuanian, some like Cajun, some Irish, a lot of Irish. You know, I'm a mutt.
You've got that Irish sort of, like, you got the Irish hair color down. It's not ginger, but like it's sort of sandy.
When it gets long, it's ginger. Red in pictures.
How's the feeling in camp going into like this record? Like, obviously, like, you know, you don't release anything unless it's amazing, but like, do you have the nervosa of not being able to do it justice because of what's going on, or is it easier?
I think we're just feeling our way around it, man. I mean, the one thing that we know is that we're excited about the record. We think it's our best album. And so it's been really painful for us not to release the record yet. You know, it was supposed to come out before we did Coachella, which was scheduled for April, and then the bomb basically hit the industry and everything shut down, and everything was up in the air, and nobody was able to really make any real maneuvers, and a lot of artists basically were like, fuck it, I'm not releasing this shit until next year. That was never an option for us. We spent too much time on this record and we were too ready to go. I mean, right before this all set off, I was in LA for 2 months training. I had like a fucking personal trainer, and I was like, you know, every day I was like Rocky. I had quit smoking, which you can see that's done now.
That's done well, yeah.
I quit smoking for like 2 months. Last year I quit smoking for 8 months. This time I quit smoking for 2 months. We were rehearsing, we shot the Ooh La La video, like everything was going as planned. We were getting ready to go on the biggest tour of our lives with Rage Against the Machine. And then we got home, and not a couple of days after we got home, basically it was a lockdown, you know? So that obviously threw us for a loop, but it threw everyone for a loop. It's a little bit different when you know, it's really hard to just personalize that and be like, oh, my plans were ruined, you know, because it's like, no, actually 80,000 people are dead in America.
So yeah.
That's not really your plan being ruined, is it? And so, you know, we're excited to drop the record. This is what we are about. And this is it, you know, we'll tour next year. You know, the tour is rescheduled for, you know, for the summer of next year.
Is that the Rage Against the Machine tour?
Yeah. It's on. It's scheduled.
A wet dream for everybody, like that lineup.
It's crazy, you know, and it's like, you know, it's such a amazing sort of confluence of events and you know, and just such an honor to even rock with those guys. And but, you know, we still have this record, and we were like, and it was proposed to us, like, do you guys want to wait until, you know, until next year or late this year or whatever? And we were just like, honestly, the truth of the matter is that not only for our purposes of just like, man, you know, we want to share this with people. We've been working really hard on this record it's been 2 years of my life, really.
Yeah.
But also, I can't think of a better time to give people something fucking raw and dope and fun.
Yeah.
And right now,
yeah, know, big
just,
time.
It just doesn't. It's just like the way that RTJ operates. We're not really a thinking operation, you know. It's always been mostly on gut and mostly just spontaneous, you know. Like, for instance, like we jumped our street date last time and just dropped it on Christmas, and that's you know, that's the type of crew that you're dealing with. So telling us that we have to wait is tough. We've given as much as we can, and now we're like, no, we're dropping this fucking record on June 5th. So we fought for that. We had to fight for that.
Nobody really tells RTJ, nobody tells LP Killer Mike what to do at all. Because, like, you know, you are the biggest DIY band in the world, right? In essence, like, you're the biggest independent artists. Like, you know, I there's one thing I've always admired outside of the music. Like, I mean, like, there'd be no reason for us to talk if I didn't like your music. It slaps like fuck. Like, but like when outside of that, when you see somebody achieve as much as you guys have achieved from an independent background and owning your own shit and calling your own shots, that doesn't happen that often, and it is inspiring to watch. Like, did you have a template to work from, like, when you guys were starting out? You're like, oh, okay, that band did it the way we like it, or that group did it the way we like
it. We had our own histories to work from, you know. One of the advantages of being, you know, around a while is that you have some experience, you know, and I've done it in multiple different ways throughout the years, you know. One thing that we just sort of agreed on from the beginning was that it had to feel, everything that we did had to feel like we were doing it for the right reason. Everything, every move that we made had to feel like we were making the move for not only the smart reason, you know, because we want our work to count, but also for a reason that we could look people in the eyes and be like, we're trying as best as we can to figure out how to do this in an honorable way. You know, it's one of the reasons why we give the records away for free, as in addition to selling it, you know, because we recognized really early that it seemed like a really pure gesture to say to people, hey, if you don't know if you fuck with this, or if you don't have it in your budget right now to buy music, which a lot of people, especially right now, don't.
Yeah.
Or if you don't, or if you just want to hear the record before you decide whether or not you want to buy it, or you want to come to a show and you want to buy a sweatshirt, or all we have to give you is music. So here, take it. Mm-hmm. And if you like it, then let's try and create a relationship here. Like, we'll try and make the best shit possible. And wherever you can, if you're into it, support it. And that really came from both of our experiences and just sort of recognizing what the reality of things were today and the way that people consume music, and being like, look, it's not the old way anymore. We're not, you know, a lot of people were really grumpy and really sort of resentful of the fact that the industry had changed, you know?
It's taken them a long time to figure it out now.
For sure. And the technology had interceded, but more so than people figuring out what the technology was going to do to the industry and the bottom line and all that shit, it seemed like people couldn't quite grasp what it meant for the culture, the way that kids actually consume music and what the relationship you're supposed to have with those kids is. And we quickly identified it in our minds, you know, as best as we could, which is basically like, you know, this is a generation that cannot be tricked into something. This is a generation of people that cannot be fooled into buying a record if the record isn't up to par for them. You have to earn that. You don't get that automatic support unless you are earning it on, you know, on a consistent basis. I think that we have people now who will buy our records just on sight unseen because they know that, you know, we have a history of really putting our all into these records. But in order for us to establish our relationship, we had to give something, you know. And I think that that's the thing that artists need to realize, is like, you have to give something in order to earn that relationship. And so, you know, again, you know, I'm rambling a little bit, but that sort of was all just the result of our experience and also just us in our hearts just sort of being like, this is after all this time putting records out on different in different companies and doing different things, and none of the business matters anymore. None of the bit, whether you're on a major label or independent or anything, it really doesn't make a fucking difference. The question is, are you do you have like genuine respect from the people that are supporting you because you've earned it, and are you putting out the best records that you possibly can? And so, you know,
I mean, that's what I was gonna say, is like the word that came to mind when you were talking about that is respect. And it's like that 50-50 grassroots respect, where you're sort of like, you're not standing on the stage when it comes to marketing, you're standing on the same level as your fans, going, we've got some cool shit, you might like it. They listen to it, and then, you know, there's some fans go and they might purchase other bits and pieces. But the thing I think about with RTJ, like in terms of live, or in terms of just fans. It's like you're almost like a rock band more than like a hip hop group. Like I see people, like, you know, I'm in London quite a lot. Like, I've got my RTJ t-shirt, like, and there's just walking billboards, like, walking around, repping RTJ and proud to rep it as well. And you don't really get that very often, I think.
That's awesome. It's funny. That's what our tour manager told us. He was like, you guys are rap. You guys are clearly rap and you're nasty. And he was like, but you conduct yourselves in terms of the way that you do this shit, like a rock band, in the sense that there's not a lot of people in our industry that tour the way that we do, you know, like we toured the last record for a year and a half straight. And we did that because we could. We did that because we had the opportunity, because people wanted to see us. And that's really rare. I think that you don't always get that. It's not, and so for us, it was like, look, every moment is a fantasy for us. Every moment is a dream come true for us to be doing what we love doing for this long and to have it still mean something to people. So we're going to take that opportunity to try and we're going to do it, no matter how exhausting it is. And no matter how much, you know, no matter how much we'd rather be home smoking weed, making more. So it's true. The parallels are real. I mean, that's a really that, you know, and I think that it's really sort of helped us because of the strength of our shows, because people are walking away from the shows also knowing that they saw two guys like give everything they fucking had that day. You know, we're not just kind of coasting through these things. Like we give a shit about the experience on every level, from the record to the show. And it's been amazing, man. I couldn't imagine when we first started this that it would have gotten to where it is. But nor did I want to imagine. I was like, well, no, I'm a solo artist. This is a mixtape.
Yeah, like, exactly. And fucking hell, man! Like, did it snowball? Like, I almost want to talk about the live show, because there's not a spoiled breath in the like 90 minutes or whatever it is that you guys do, and I don't understand how you've got the fitness for it. Like, obviously you said that you did like, what, I don't know, like weeks and weeks of training beforehand. But when you play levels, like shows of the level that you're at now, like, and you know, you've got those big stages, like it's not long. RTJ6, you'll have that ramp that like Angus Young and AC/DC had.
I'm saving up for it now. Yeah.
Do you,
or at least a little Stonehenge, you know?
Oh, a little Spinal Tap Stonehenge. Yeah. Instead, I'll tell you what, we'll come back to Glastonbury in a minute. But like those like club shows, like that you would have played, like I'm sure like, when you were coming up, you would have played in places like Babies All Right and stuff in New York.
Babies All Right didn't exist at the time, but stuff of that level.
Of that ilk. So like, yeah. Like, what did you learn from like those early shows that you did in New York? And like, how do you take that hype to the big stage?
I mean, the truth of the matter is that even when Run the Jewels started, we were playing to 500 people a night, you know, and that was a good night. That was like, oh, we sold out 500 people. That's great. We were happy doing that. We were like, oh, when we get to the major cities, we'll do 1,000 people, you know, and we'll be counting every fucking head, you know, we're going on at 9. How many tickets have we sold, you know? And things turned around for us and went really big. And, you know, we're playing to, you know, 12,000-15,000 people in New York. We're playing to, you know, 10,000-12,000 people in LA. It's gotten bigger than we had ever imagined. But the truth of the matter is, man, we never changed our approach to our stage show. And I think that is the thing that I learned. I think that when you are for years performing in, you know, small to medium sized venues, you don't really imagine that it's going to get much bigger than that. You just want to give the biggest show in that context possible. And there's no, because we did that for so long and because we trained ourselves to just say, look, if sometimes you'd be on the road and 100 people would show up, you know, and this isn't so long ago for us. This is like 2013, you know.
Does that make it special though, that like now that you're coming to like those first couple of sold out shows, you must have been crying into each other's shoulders, like?
Yeah, and then when it started to be, wait a second, we sold the tour out? Like, what are you talking about? That doesn't make sense. Like, we sold the tour out when we, like, in a day? Like, yeah. And
why did we not put on more tickets?
Right, and you know, And, you know, when you start getting to that mythical place where they start bumping you up in venues and stuff, this is stuff that I had only heard rumors about, you know, like,
yeah,
I knew that it happened for other people, but I was quite satisfied with just kind of having a fan base and doing, doing a bunch of shows for, and grinding it out. But we never changed our energy. We always performed in all of those little shows, no matter what, even if 60 fucking people showed up, which occasionally they did. We performed like we were in a stadium, because to us, this was our stadium. We never expected to get any bigger than that. Now we're literally playing in stadiums, and it was an easy transition for us because we had a lot of practice. We always gave everything that we had in that situation. We never tempered it down based on who came, because, you know, we figure, and we always did figure, and this is what I will say about us, is always one of the things I'm glad that we always had an agreement about this. Me and Mike have always been in the same place of being really, just being really grateful for what we did have, you mm-hmm. know, not walking around being, thinking there should be something bigger for us. There should be something better. This isn't good enough. So when all the stuff started to pop off in a real way, it was all amazement. It was all like, oh shit. You know, like, we never got used to it. We're not these guys who just assume now that what, you know, that everything's gonna, like, there's a creeping feeling in the back of your head at all times. Like, all right, jig is up. Like, joke on me. When's this going to stop?
I get that.
You know?
I get,
like,
that.
When
yeah.
does it stop? You know? So.
But when you've got that ability to be able to suck every single fan up onto that stage when you're doing it, like, you get people who want you to come on tour with the even bigger arenas than you're playing, like, you know, Eminem, Jack White. Like, when you go and play those shows, like, you obviously probably learn even more from people like Eminem, people like Jack White, and how they do it.
Well, sure. I mean, we've had a lot of experience, man. You know, we've been around, and been around a lot of big acts and for a long time. And in general, I mean, Mike came up under Outkast. You know, he was there.
Of course,
he was
yeah.
there, watching that whole. Basically, what's happening to us now in terms of our careers? He was there to watch it unfold with Outkast, and he was. So he had that basis of, like, he kind of knew what that was about, and the thing that you learn isn't as much about what it is that the people who are sort of, like, if you're in a situation where you're playing in front of Eminem is Eminem, period. No one else is Eminem. You know what I mean?
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
There's not much to learn except to look at it and be like, you know what? That guy's handling being Eminem really well.
You know? Yeah, you're the best Eminem, like, I've seen.
But like, really, like, you know, yeah. not everybody does. And that's often what draws a line between people who can handle fame and exposure and can harness it and do right by their fans and not. And, you know, Eminem is a great example of somebody who can, because you watch his show and you're like, this dude has been in this game as long as I have, but he's been way bigger for way longer than I have. And he's still giving everything. And so, you know, and that's a reaffirmation. But when you open those, when you open for people like that, you have to simply get yourself in the mind state of, like, I'm supposed to be here, and I am going to try and make it a little bit difficult for him to follow.
That's good. I like that. I like that competition.
That's all you're supposed to do. That's yeah. when we bring opening acts on the road with us, that's what we expect. Like, listen, it's not going to work, but I need you to try to blow me off the stage every night. I need you to try to make it uncomfortable yeah. for us as best as you can.
Oh my God.
That's all I require of you. Like, go for it, please. Cut my head off. No way you're going to win right now, because my name's on the fucking thing. But, you know, so that's what I took from that. You know, everyone is different, you know, for the most part, you know, you kind of just do your
get
thing.
Summoned?
But someone like M was, you know, was really kind and, you know, to us, nice to us, and Lord as well, you know, but for the most part, everyone's there to do a job. I mean, the thing that you have to realize is that when people are on that level, you know, or shit, even like the Rage Against the Machine level, which is at like the highest level that you can get, really. Yeah.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
The enormous burden and cost on those people and the enormous responsibility to keep the whole thing afloat is
huge, gigantic. Yeah.
And so it has to be almost run like the military. It has to be like, you know, everybody is doing everything they can to do their part to make sure that they can bring a fucking stadium show with full production to people. Sometimes it baffles me to be in those moments, you know, to look and to see really what goes on, because we're at a certain level, but the fact that it matters is that Run the Jewels is a small crew, man. We, you know, the biggest thing that we did was get like a second tour bus.
Yeah.
And it's like
the Rage Against the Machine tour. Were they a band that had a big influence on you? I mean, like they're basically catnip to teenagers, and they have been since it started. Like, did they have an influence on you growing up?
I wasn't a teenager. I'm 44 years old. So,
but when you were like, when you, when,
hold on a second, I'm 45 now. I really liked their music.
Mm.
I really liked their music, but I wasn't a teenager. At least when I got into it, and I was in my early 20s, I think. And you know, I've known Zach since back then. I've known Zach since basically 1998, something like that.
It's like Battle of Los Angeles times.
After Battle of Los Angeles, when they broke up, when they had their falling out and broke up, Zach came to Brooklyn to stay in my place for a month, and we worked on music. So that was even back then.
Did that stuff ever make the? Did it ever see the light of day? That music?
No, and the truth is, we didn't really accomplish that much. You know, we had some songs, but I was really new and young, and no one had ever asked me to like really do anything. I was just in Company Flow. I was just like, a hot, you know, a producer from a hot group. Zach is so real that he was like, okay, yeah, I could literally get anybody to. I could get like fucking George Martin to produce my record.
I would pay for that. Well, pay to listen to it.
I'm gonna go to this just underground rapper's shitty apartment in Brooklyn and stay there for a month, and that's who I want to work with. So that's how me and Zach became friends, and we've stayed friends since then. And the reason, of course, that I said yes was because of their music. Because I was like, A, if you're a rap fan, you recognize that Zach De La Rocha is a rapper, and that really appealed to people, you know, in my genre. And B, there's just the raw energy and just power of that band couldn't be denied. And so to have someone like that on that level be like, hey, call me out of nowhere and be like, hey, it's Zach De La Rocha, you know, and I'm like, sure,
yeah, sure, know, bye,
sure it is.
You might be the only person ever to even consider putting the guy who rapped Bomb Track and Killing the Name off on the same track on the same track of yours as the same guy who wrote Happy, Pharrell Williams.
I mean, Happy, he didn't just write Happy. Let's not forget, you know, that may be his biggest song ever.
No, big time. But I mean, like, having Pharrell Williams and Zach De La Rocha, it's like two opposite ends of the rap spectrum and I haven't heard it because I've seen it written
Pharrell
down.
Pharrell was the producer behind the clips, you know what I mean? And not when you think about like his history. I mean, this is like, you know, this guy produced fucking, and you know, like fucking Noriega. He's hardcore rap for sure. He's ascended to pop royalty. But one of the things that I love about these records is that I get the chance to pull people into my world that may not ever have interacted in the same way. Like, and actually someone just texted me today making fun of me. They were like, did you get two of hip hop's greatest producers on your album only to produce the song yourself?
That was my next question. It was like, did you produce the song or did Pharrell produce the song?
I did. I mean, you know, hey, what can I say? Like, this is just as much my fantasy. You know, it's like, I love the fact that I could get people from our different sort of walks of this shit together, because I'm a fan of music in general. So getting Josh Homme and Mavis Staples together.
Yeah, that was the next question. Like,
it's to me.
I get that one.
Me too. And I get that about a lot of shit. And I think that there are a lot of people who like me and like you because they listen to so much music in general, and because it doesn't mean that, you know, because you listen to one thing and another thing, it doesn't really define you either way, right? Mm. You just are searching out for stuff that moves you. And I love the producer in me because I'm a hip hop producer. So you grow up putting and taking different records and jamming them together and seeing how they work together and seeing how the sounds that aren't originally, created to be working together can create something beautiful. So I've applied that same logic to when we do guests. It's all about what's the coolest thing for the song. What will make the song good? And when you hear the Pharrell thing,
yeah,
you'll know that it's not happy.
See, like this is the inner nerd of me, because when I was like sort of looking at stuff before our interview, I was like, oh, what the fuck does Mavis Staples and Josh Homme sound like? And then I was like, do you know what, she's a protest singing badass, right? And then you've got this like desert gunslinger in Josh Homme, who's like probably one of the most forward talking, or like, you know, he says what he fucking means all the time. And I was like, this is going to be the most honest and open and raw record.
It's raw. I mean, and the truth is that like the way that it came together was crazy. I mean, I wrote this hook and we tried it like a million different ways. You know, we tried it with like me singing and Mike singing and me and Mike singing and us just rapping it. And then we had like other singers come in and we were trying to get it done. And this is after I had already gone and worked on the song with Josh. So Josh is essentially, he's a co-producer on the record. I mean, he plays a bunch of guitar on it and he does a bunch of sort of harmonizing of vocals. And we had this beautiful sort of sound bed of Josh over a beat that I had done. And we were desperate to find somebody who we felt could like, you know, match the gravitas of the hook. I was losing my mind. Mike kept pushing like, no, it's not right. Get someone else. And I was like, fuck you, man. This is fucking killing me. And yeah, at the last minute, maybe we someone in our camp, Will, our manager, one of our managers in the camp was like, what about Mavis Staples? Because Mavis Staples had reached out to Mike a few years prior to this and asked if he would be interested in like maybe writing something for her. And that never happened, but we had the connection and we reached out to Mavis. And I mean, we had reached out to everyone. We had reached out to like everyone from like Mary J. Blige, like Billie Eilish, you know, like, you know, just people that we thought were interesting that, and of course, Mary is an icon but we reached out to a lot of different people that we were like, okay, this could be a different direction. And
does that mean have you got a B track? Have you got like a B side with like Billie Eilish or with Mary J. Blige on it?
None of that happened, none of that worked out.
Yeah, it was just like ideas.
It was ideas and we were pursuing it, trying to make it happen and trying to see what it would sound like, and none of it really could happen. And then someone was like, what about Mavis? And the next day I was on a plane to Chicago, because as soon as Mavis's name came up, it was like, of course.
What? Yeah.
That's who we should have called. That was our first call. That should have been the first call. And when you hear the record, I mean, she's just such a fucking beautiful soul. And the record, you know, she, you know, I'm glad that Mike pushed me, because if I was a little annoyed. I was like, I fucking wrote this thing, man. Let me say it, you know? And he was just like, trust me, you got to get someone else to sing this shit. I was like, all right, all right. And I called Mike. Mike couldn't make it to Chicago. Me and Taco, who's one of our co-producers, went down to Chicago for the day to record with Mavis. And I called Mike like midway through the session. And I was like, you know how I've hated you for like 2 weeks now because you have, because you've been fucking annoying the shit out of me about this song. I was like, you were right. Fuck you.
Oh, yeah. he must have had such a Sammy when he said that. He was just like going, I told you so.
No, he was gracious about it, but he was jealous that he wasn't able to meet Mavis.
Yeah, so, you definitely would be. Where did Rick Rubin come into the equation with this record?
Rick is someone that I've known for a while, and that he was generous enough to offer us his studio at not a crazy exorbitant rate. So we were looking for somewhere that we could go together that was out of our zones, you know, and kind of come together in neutral territory. You know, a lot of times we'll do the records in New York, and sometimes we'll do stuff in Atlanta. And I think for this one, we just were like, let's just go somewhere where we can all hang out and be together. That allows us to just get into a zone that isn't any one thing that we're used to. Mm. And Rick offered that to us. So he wasn't really involved in the production of the album. He was just simply kind of a host for the record. He kind of let us take his place over and get comfortable. And he's great. I mean, he's the type of guy who, you see him like once a week, he'll come in shorts and flip flops and sit down and just start listening and just talk about stuff with you or whatever. And he's a great energy.
He doesn't walk though, does he? He levitates. I just get this idea that he just like levitates around and just appears behind you.
There was a picture in his in the studio of him levitating, actually.
I completely and 100% believe you.
I don't know if I'm assuming it was doctored, but yeah, it was.
If anybody listening to this that doesn't know of the behemoth that is Rick Rubin, you're going to have an interesting evening on Wikipedia. That's all I'm going to say. I want to talk to you about Glastonbury, because like that's one of my favorite performances I've seen at Glastonbury was wow. You guys coming out on stage. And that was in 2000. And oh my God, I can never remember anything. 2017, I think it was. And you came on stage after the leader of the Labour Party, Jeremy Corbyn. And I could have like written a really like, you know, good question about social politics and all the rest of it. And the only thing that would come into my head when I was trying to plan this out, I was like, who would win in a fight between Bernie Sanders and Jeremy Corbyn?
I don't know. Bernie's pretty fucking scrappy.
So are they both, like, you know, like they would grab for you, like.
I don't know who I put my money on that one. Yeah. We felt that same energy. We weren't really aware as much as you guys are aware of what he was and what he represented, but we did know enough to say, to recognize the energy and to see the effect that he was having on people. And it reminded us a lot of Bernie Sanders over here. And, you know, we had been relatively intimately connected to Bernie Sanders. Mm. Obviously Mike is literally connected to Bernie Sanders and was a surrogate for him. And, you know, Bernie like introduced us for, you know, Coachella one year. And so we had both, we both were sort of like, we just recognized that it was a powerful moment, and, you know, just respectfully, we're just, you know, they asked us if it was cool if he came on before us.
Who asks you in a situation like that? Is this some Emily Eavis, Michael Eavis? Like what happens?
I don't know. We just get told what the fuck's happening. we just get communicated through our tour manager or something, you know, and they ask, you know, hey, is it, you know, they're asking if Corbyn can come on before your set. He wanted to come on. They decided that it might be cool before our set. And you know, for the little that we knew about him, we knew enough to sort of be like, man, go for it. Like, it's, you know, this guy's obviously a powerful speaker and he's connected to, he's connected to something. Yeah, don't worry about us. Well, you know.
Yeah, there was a whole movement around that time grime MCs, like sort of inner city grime MCs took to Jeremy Corbyn like you wouldn't believe. Well, the Glastonbury performance was absolutely incredible. And there's so many other things I was thinking about around this album. Is like, you're probably one of the most creative marketing bands like that there are out there. Like, there's so many things that come along with like RTJ, like outside of the music for fans. Like, you know, you've got the RTJ beer, you've got the sort of Meow the Jewels album that came out. Like, you never really know what you're going to go with next. And I think I got like a little snippet that you might be getting into the weed game.
Yeah, we're launching our first strain, actually. Yeah.
What do you like? How do you like? What do you do like to make sure? Apart from like, do you have to like smoke loads of different types of weed to like figure out which one's the right one to go with? And are you in a lab coat when you're doing it?
Listen, it's a tough job, but you know, we're dedicated to our work, and. Yeah, we tested a bunch of strains. Something that we wanted to get into for a long time, just because we're enthusiasts. So you know, it makes a lot of sense for us. But yeah, it's funny. It's been a process. It's been like a couple of year process of us just kind of getting it together and different, you know, different strains and stuff being sent our way, and us you know. It's a really good job.
Yeah, I would imagine like if you enjoy weed, then it definitely is. Like, because it's still illegal in the UK. Like, my sort of knowledge on strains and people having their own brands of it, it's like completely next to nothing, really. But I know that I know like Mike Tyson's got one and Meek Mill's got one. Do people buy it like they would like Pepsi or Dr. Pepper or Fanta? Do they walk into a shop and they go, "I'll have two bags of Mike Tyson," or "I'll have a bag of RTJ"? I don't know. I've like literally have no idea how it works.
Yes, they do.
So it's like a 7-Eleven. You just go in, pick it up.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's like there's fucking like there's places that are like the fucking Apple store that, like, you know, it's like it's not in New York or other states that aren't fully recreationally legal or really don't have like an established medical you know, retail system, that are still kind of pushing it through or whatever, but places that are established like Cali and, you know, other places on the West Coast, mostly West Coast stuff, but other places have made it legal throughout the East Coast as well. There's a real, yeah, absolutely. You walk into the store and you pick and they sell you on it. They're like, "Oh, what are you interested in?" You know? And they, you know, it's like any other retail experience, except that you have to, you know, show your ID.
But like, if it took off in such a way, could it like be feasible that people who've never even heard of your band could be smoking your name?
Totally.
That's just like, like when you were starting out making music, like in your room as a kid, like that's not that's not even a phantom thought that came to your head, right?
No, when I was a kid, it was like, how can I get weed? Like, how is it possible to get weed? I grew up in New York, man. Weed was not easy to get to acquire, and even when you did, it was shitty. So the advent of, like, you know, the advent of that has been a joy to experience. Of course, there's a dark side to it too, because, you know, you have a country that's legalizing marijuana that has a history of imprisoning poor people for selling marijuana.
And for a really long time as well, like
And people who are getting disproportionate penalties based on small amounts of marijuana that are still in prison now. And then you have giant corporations and politicians, you know, phasing into, you know, the marijuana industry without dealing with the ghosts of our past. Which, but
if you got like banged up in a prison for selling like weed a couple of years ago and it's been made legal in that state, surely common sense would say that if it's legal, then you can go free. I mean, like, you know, you could fill a warehouse with what I don't know about American politics.
This is America, buddy. We don't deal in common sense, okay? This is you know, if we dealt in common sense, we wouldn't have the fucking president that we have.
Yeah, I'm still drinking bleach over here.
Keep at it. It'll work, you know.
How's the RTJ movie coming along? Slowly but surely, but it's coming, right?
It's in gestation phase, but it's coming. Yeah. I mean, we've got a working one page, you know, idea, and that's in the cards for sure. Those doors are opening to us, and it's been sort of, it's it's something that we always said after we did this record that we would start focusing on. So I think the next thing that, you know, we just want to be like, you know, the new Blues Brothers, but like with weed and guns. You know?
I mean, like there needs to be a new Blues Brothers. Like there really does. But like, right. So I'd imagine, like, you know, I've watched your videos. You are both very capable of standing in front of the camera and making yourselves look good. But if you weren't, right, like who would play you? Who would play Mike?
I always said that I would get Blair Underwood to play me, you know, like he did Rick Rubin in Crush. I mean, like he did Russell Simmons in Crush Groove.
Uh-huh.
That might be a bit of a not, that might not work ultimately. I don't know. It's a good question. I mean, it's funny because when you're in a group like Run the Jewels, literally every time anyone sees a picture of like a white guy standing next to a tall black guy, they send it to us and they just go, Run the Jewels. It's like, I get the feeling we could literally just choose anybody and it would be fine. No one would even notice.
So one of the last things I wanted to ask you is like, I've seen your music pop up in some really cool places, like over the years, like Deadpool was a real cool one. I'm pretty sure
Deadpool. Yeah.
It was in Deadpool and it was in Venom. And I think, Roma. And it's popped up in cool places where you're like, this really works. Have you ever seen or heard it played in somewhere really inappropriate where you're like, why are they fucking playing it as a pregnancy test in Singapore? like, what's going on here?
No. And the answer is because we control our masters. And so we approve where our music goes unless someone is using it without permission.
So, do you get requests? So, because I know like a Charlie XCX, an artist over here, got like, I remember she was telling me she got a request from the British Army to use it, use her music, and she was like,
Yeah, we refuse to do stuff based on our principles all the time. I won't honor any requests from the NFL. I won't honor any requests from the military. I won't honor any requests from soda companies. You know
why soda companies? Just because of the
listen, I'd rather give my music to a cigarette company because at least they say that you have to be of age to smoke them. You know, I just feel like, you know, hey, why would I lend my credibility to a company that is pumping fucking, you know, bullshit into children? I'd sooner give it to a liquor company. I have no problem doing that because it's understood, you know, this is an adult thing. You're making an adult decision here, but you know, stuff where it feels like manipulation of children or stuff where it feels like it presents what we do in a sinister light somehow.
Do you think you should be a certain age to be able to drink soda?
No, I don't. But I also just don't have to lend my music to the ruthless advertising.
Yeah.
You know, like, I mean, soda is just an example. It's not like one giant pillar that I stand on.
Yeah.
You know, but it's just something that I'm like, man, I don't want to do that.
There's an MC in London who was on this podcast at the very beginning called Novelist, and he was to tell me that he's about 18 or 19, and he was like talking really passionately about how Rubicon and fizzy drinks was way worse for his community growing up than drugs were, because it was killing people. It was just killing people that were drinking it flat out, from diabetes, heart problems.
Yeah,
you know,
absolutely, like that's straight up. Yeah, no question. And so, you know, I think that you have to have control over that stuff. You have to decide where your line is, where you feel good. I have no problem licensing music to movies. I love movies.
Yeah.
You know, I don't know what to say. Like, I love movies. I just scored a movie called Fonzo starring Tom Harding. Oh, it's called Capone now, starring Tom Harding. That just came out in the States. And you know, so I'm a big movie enthusiast, so yeah, our music in a film is awesome to me, you
so
know?
There's one movie for me to watch, obviously. Like, I've got a lot of spare time on my hands, like, so maybe you could give us like one movie for all the listeners of this podcast and all the Run the Jewels fans to watch to ease the boredom a little bit.
Ease the boredom? Well, I mean, you know, there are a couple staples. Whenever I'm feeling a little bit depressed, my new go-to movie that feels good is What We Do in the Shadows. That's been a pretty steady staple for me for about 5-6 years.
Solid, yeah.
What We Do in the Shadows. If you want to watch a movie that will blow your mind, and that will maybe even mean something to you in the chaos, I would say watch Stanley Kubrick's Dr. Strangelove.
Oh, I love that movie. That's like, I think I did like a semester of film studies when I was like at university, and we did that one.
Cool.
Yeah.
That's, you know, it's an all-time classic. And you know, I would say if you want to binge something, I would always say The Wire.
Get The Wire on. Get into it again.
The Wire, or The Sopranos. You know, that's always
Succession's a good one. The new one, man. Succession is so fucking good.
Succession is amazing. My wife is obsessed with that show. It's good.
Yeah, it's
good.
It's wicked, man.
I watched like 6 episodes, so I didn't really get a chance to see the whole thing.
I'm into it. Listen, man, thank you so much for taking the time out to chat to me. Give my love to Killer Mike.
I'm sorry that he couldn't make it. I think something came up. I think that was one of the, that's why I was late. But I will absolutely extend that to him.
RTJ4 is going to fucking save my summer. Thank God you're releasing it. Thank God you didn't hold back.
I hope you enjoy it, man. We're really excited about it. And, you know, We definitely left the album like this is we gave it our all, and this is, you know, and that's our only requirement. It's like we don't want to drop anything that we don't feel like we did our best. And I think people are going to be surprised at this record. So, yeah.
Happy days, man. Thank you for coming on the podcast. Stay safe, and I look forward to getting my teeth gripped into it.
All right, man. Be well.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince? They exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight, and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.